This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
An effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy as well. Hump Day PDX is June 12th from 6 to 10 p.m. and every second Wednesday of the month thereafter at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta. Today, we're featuring an interview with award-winning Filipina author Marivie Solivan. She's the author of The Mango Bride. This novel follows the story of two Filipina immigrants and how their past in the Philippines dictates their present lives in Oakland, California. Marivie Solivan hails from Manila and currently lives in San Diego, California. Growing up in the Philippines, she always had an interest in writing, a dangerous career while the country was still under martial law. Her career did begin with publishing children's books, the inspiration for which began with writing poems as an economic and poignant gift for friends' children. Upon moving to the United States, Marivie Solivan found herself needing to find a new path. She began writing short stories for an online magazine in the Philippines, which led to fiction writing. The collection of these stories on immigration became her first publication, Suddenly Stateside, a bestseller in the Philippines. Her first long-form novel, The Mango Bride, has won much acclaim. Even as an unpublished manuscript, it won the Carlos Palanca Memorial Award for Literature, the Philippine version of the Pulitzer Prize. In our conversation, Marivie Solivan talks about the new title and the award.
Well, what happened was, when I finished the novel, I really had no idea what to call it, and I had all of these, like, combinations. There's actually some apparently website where you can go to where you plug in the name, the components of the title, and they will tell you via some bizarre algorithm whether or not the title would determine it's becoming a bestseller. And, you know, I plugged it in. It seemed to be kind of okay. And I was like, I like the S sound. And it was about service, and it did have to do with secrets, so it kind of made sense. But I was never really completely happy with it, just because it sounded kind of like a CIA novel, like the Secret Service. The Palanca Awards are like, they're annual awards for all genres of literature, from playwriting to the, you know, short fiction to children's stories, the essay, personal essay. But the novel category only comes up every 2 years because it's so long. And so it just happened, luckily, that the year that I had done my manuscript, the novel category was on. So under that name, In the Service of Secrets, they submitted it. And I signed on with Penguin on April 11, and on August, sometime in August, I got the email saying that the novel had won the prize. And I was like, oh, my God, this was like 3 days after my favorite aunt had died, and It was just like, oh my God, this is a sign. You know, she really advocated for me in some strange way. Yeah, so actually I came up with the title of The Mango Bride, but it was with the encouragement of my editor.
Well, first I wanted to talk about one of the characters in the book, Amparo, is an interpreter, and you are as well. So I was wondering the relationship between you and the character, or the stories that resonate in the book. And you don't have to go into great detail. I understand that there are confidentiality issues, but some of the experiences you've had.
Well, I just found that, you know, I'm a storyteller, and I just felt like being in, you know, in doing the day job that I do really allows me access to so many stories. And some of them are just really kind of heartbreaking, and some of them are just kind of funny. One of the things I found from the little I know about Filipino-American migration patterns and history is that not a lot has changed in terms of where the Filipinos are. Like, I'll do a lot of you know, interpretation for unemployment benefits or some kind of court case for Filipinos who still work in the canneries in Alaska. I mean, 100 years later, they're still doing it. Things like that are just kind of odd. Like, there's this one poor man, and he sounded so downtrodden. It was by the magistrate in Alaska, and she was trying him for a case of or solicitation. He sounded really downtrodden, and the magistrate was female, and I was a female, and I couldn't see them because I was interpreting for them.
Right, these are interpreters over the phone, sure.
Right. The way it's set up was she was asking him, like, so do you understand what you've been accused of is a crime of solicitation? And as far as I know, there isn't a direct translation of that word into Tagalog. There's not the one word. So you're not allowed to embroider around it. So I said, could you please define that so I can interpret the definition? And she was like, well, it was paying a woman for sex. Translated doesn't sound as polite as it sounds in English. You were asking this person for a specific act. And he seemed to be very downtrodden. He was ready to take anything she wanted to throw at him. And there came a time in the conversation where she was like, and I have to inform you if you're right to get court representation. And if you can't afford one, one will be assigned to you. She said, how much money do you make? Because we want you to know that this is the amount of money that we could fine you for. And he said, well, I earn $18,000 a year, and I support one child. My wife is dead. My child is in the Philippines. And, you know, at that point, I thought to myself, this poor man, it was January in Alaska. All he wanted was a warm hand somewhere on his person. And he was a widower, you know. And at that point, I think even the judge's tone kind of softened because she actually kind of advocated for him. She was like, well, you know, you might want to have an attorney assigned to you because maybe there will be a loophole in the law that will get you a lighter sentence. And then I could see these poor people, they're really caught somewhere. I mean, Filipinos are not DNA engineered for the snow. And to be in a land where it's perpetually cold and dark and frozen, and to be a widower and your only family is a 12-year-old in the Philippines who doesn't probably know you anymore. I mean, I thought that was just heartbreaking.
Wow, definitely a wealth of different kinds of stories and people. I was also curious, there were a few themes in the book that I wanted to talk about as far as a relationship to your own personal life.
Yeah.
One of which, of course, is immigration.
Yeah.
So two characters who are women who immigrate from the Philippines to Oakland for different reasons, and then how their lives completely shift once they are stateside, for better or for worse, you know, based on the lives that they had in the Philippines. And so I guess one of the things I wanted you to talk about was these experiences of immigration from the perspective of a Filipina woman, as well as what people gain and what they lose when they choose to immigrate and leave that life.
It's interesting because like I was telling you earlier, I had never experienced being a minority. Like, I come from a majority culture, like a majority religion. I was in the Philippines. We were Filipino. I mean, okay, there were Chinese Filipinos, but, you know, everybody was basically on the same level. And the only differences were in terms of class, like it was a money thing. And sometimes, but less often, a religious thing, because really it was mostly Catholic. So I had to be reminded when I came here that I was a minority. And I remember being in Boston and I hung out with a bunch of like disgruntled minority grad students because, you know, it was a very white community.
Strangers in a strange land.
Yes, exactly. That's a good way
together.
To put it. Yeah. I must have said something really ignorant, but she said to me, you know, it doesn't matter how pale your skin is. You'll always be colored in America. And I was like, oh, she's right. Okay, then, whatever that means. So I went home, and around the time that we decided to get married, my husband, who's Filipino-American, full Filipino, born in Detroit, completely American, but for his ethnicity, we were trying to get a fiancé visa, which didn't work out because we would have had to be apart for a full year that it took to process, and we didn't want to wait that long. So anyway, I remember going up to the window where you make your requests for visas, and he was talking to the, you know, the white woman that was handling all of these requests, and she was like, oh, your accent is flawless. She says to my husband, and I wanted to slap her. I was like, what do you mean his accent is flawless? He hasn't rehearsed for it. He was born into the accent. So I was like, oh, so that's how they roll. So anyway, it wasn't such a hard landing. We were in Berkeley, which is, after all, mostly like people from somewhere else. I felt very much integrated. And it was easy for me because, well, easy in one sense. Easy in the sense that I was a stranger among many other strangers, all from different places. And we're all kind of like trying to find our own way. Not so easy in terms of like all of a sudden I had left this large community of people, generations of people who knew me from my family, who knew me from classmates from school that I had known since, you know, third grade. All of a sudden, I was a nobody in somebody else's country. And I had to really just find my way. I had to, and I have to say, I went through many different jobs over the 7 years that we were there. The one consistent job that I kept, which was not a paying job, was writing.
Yeah, there's definitely issues with how we regard people based on how they look and how they sound. I've definitely been through what your husband has been through.
Yeah.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is an interview with award-winning Filipino author Marivy Solivan. She has been on tour and was a featured author at the Left Bank Project last month. We continued our conversation of immigration and how it functions in her book.
Goes back a long way. Around the time of, even before World War II, there were a lot of Filipino recruits to the Navy, the U.S. Navy, and that was their way to get into the United States. The Navy at that point, I forget what year it was that the rule changed, but up until a certain point, until I think like 1940s perhaps, the best you could do if you were a Filipino as a naval recruit was be a steward. You're basically walking dogs for the officers, serving meals, pressing clothes, cooking. That's what you got. But it got you into the United States. So a lot of these people then were discharged. They began to stay on as migrant workers and whatever. So all of these people, this was the time of anti-miscegenation laws, so they were not allowed to marry. So they were basically migrant workers, but they had already decided to stay here. Maybe they were sending money home to their families in the Philippines. But when World War II was declared, suddenly they needed to have more men than there were white men, I guess, to enlist. So the president at the time said that even though Filipinos were not specifically citizens, I think, and I want to get the history right, they were offered a path to citizenship and they're allowed to enlist. So there are, you know, all of these people, service workers from across the country, migrant workers from California, came down and enlisted to fight in this war. And they were offered veterans benefits, just like everybody else who was, you know, offered veterans benefits. And so what happened was they went, they fought the war, a lot of them died. But when they came back, Congress passed the Rescission Act, which rescinded the veterans benefits promised to all of these Filipinos. So there were 66 countries that fought in the war, and except for the Philippines, all of the veterans from those countries received some kind of veterans benefits in terms of, I don't know, pensions or health care benefits.
And what was the argument for rescinding these benefits?
I don't know. I haven't done the research into it. All I know is that was how they repealed this promise. I think the best that the Filipinos got out of it was citizenship, but then you have to understand, a lot of these people had fought in the war. Not all of them were married because in their youth, they were denied that with the anti-miscegenation laws. I don't know when those laws were repealed. But the net effect of it was there was an entire generation of men who did not have families. There are a generation of bachelors that are slowly dying out. They had fought in the war. Many of them are in their 80s or probably close to 90s, and they have no benefits. And it's just obscene the way the government has treated them, you know. They have no family to support them in their old age. They have no health care benefits. They might have social security. I don't know the technicalities of it. But whatever regular veterans are getting, they do not get. And I thought that was supremely unfair for a whole generation of men who had given their lives, really, to fight somebody else's war. It was not the Philippines' war to begin with. So, and, you know, at the time that we were in Berkeley, this fight for the veterans' benefits was gathering steam. I guess now it's kind of moved into a bill. So progress is being made. But at what cost? I mean, half of these people, or maybe not half, but a large number of these people have already died. So,
and I don't think it's well known that this is the case with specifically with these Filipino men who fought in the war. I don't think that this is a well-known act or situation. You know, it's been so many years.
It's been so many years. I mean, who is going to advocate for them except the few people who care? And since they have no direct relatives, really no one cares unless you, for whatever reason you have, decide to take up the fight.
Have you met any veterans?
I have. I've heard of them. I haven't met them directly. But I did know there was actually a character much like Manong Del, who I based the Manong Del character on. He did, in fact, rent chess tables out of Market Street by the Powell Street BART. And that was his thing. And he would send money home to the Philippines. And he would just set out these tables that he had rented. And old-timers would sit there because really there was no other place for them to go. And I don't know how much he rented them for, but it was not for very much. Yeah, it was their own little community. And I used to see them. He's retired now. He must be very old.
Well, it also segues into another, I mean, big issue in the book is about immigration. And there is a moment with those characters, with these elderly gentlemen, where I think Amparo is asking, why don't you just go back? And he's, and the character responds with, this is my country. I've been here for so long. And whether you've been here for a year or 70, I think that that is a situation that, that plays into what you call home.
Yeah, the thing about home is it is so complex. Like, I remember when I was here originally, every time I said here, I was referring to Manila, which is my home growing up. But over the years, over the 18 years I've lived here, my here has shifted to here, the United States. But that was a very gradual shift. And I think psychically, some people never really make that shift. Their here will always be back in Manila or wherever they're from. Whereas I think in Manong Del's particular case, because he had no family that was already that was still living in Manila, and obviously he had no family here, but he had this community of other old, aging bachelors, he had had to make the, you know, the switch over, that there was nothing for him to return to in Manila. And I don't think he came from much wealth anyway, so it wasn't like there was any property for him left to reclaim. Whereas with Amparo, it was like she had this whole family network in Manila, but through some circumstances, she had had to abandon them. And at the same time, she had one uncle in the United States. So she was kind of caught between the two worlds. And she was still at the, that point when they have that conversation, trying to decide, well, where is home going to be for me? Am I going to make the big step and switch over? Or am I still always going to be yearning? So it's a very fluid kind of thing.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm Sarika Mehta. Today, we're featuring an interview with Marivie Sullivan, author of The Mango Bride. One of the characters in her story arrives to the U.S. as a mail-order bride, which is a global and contemporary problem.
I don't know. I didn't set out intending to write a novel about, like, mail-order brides, but I think in the back of my head, I thought that that issue really needed to be brought up to fore, especially now that people are talking about, like, you know, the DREAM Act and things that are going on and violence against women. And because I see it all the time, like, people are talking about how, like, immigrants come here hoping for a better life, and many of them do, but many of them also come under great duress, coming from a time of great duress. So it's really not a win-win. It's more like a lose-lose situation. And I think that needs to be brought into the conversation, because especially when women come into this country contracted for marriage under whatever agreement, it could be a religious contracting, it could be a commercial contracting, is what happened to Beverly. But they really are at a very unequal power dynamic because, well, unless they have a job waiting for them, really, they're really under the thumb of the man who invited them over. And I've seen, I've translated for too many domestic violence calls where the man had taken away her passport or threatened her with deportation, said things like, you owe, you know, your life to me because I brought you over here, that I think people need to understand that even as there are many interracial marriages that come from, like, these long-term, long-distance relationships that succeed and are very happy and enduring, there's also this other side of it that can be really kind of hurtful and violent. And I remember, I never forgot, a social worker told me once, when the economy goes south, domestic violence goes up, because women become expendable. They're just another expense that you don't want to have to pay for. And if a man is at home, unemployed or disgruntled because he's taking a pay cut or furlough or whatever, he'll pick the nearest target to vent his rage on. And usually it's the wife or the children. It's a sad reality for immigrants. And I'm keenly aware of that because I see a lot of it in my job, and I see a lot of it just on the street.
Backing up a little bit about the mail order brides, mm-hmm. can you go back to how a woman finds herself in that situation?
I discovered them, like, I don't know, we were still in the Bay Area, so that must have been like in the 1998 kind of period. And there is a free newspaper with a lot of classified ads. And I don't know if I was looking for a job or just scanning the ads just because I had nothing better to do. And I saw an ad for something called Filipina Heart or Filipina Sweetheart or something.com. And I, you know, out of curiosity, went to look at it. And it was basically this mail order bride thing. And I was like, oh, out of fun, just for fun, I'll look at who is putting themselves out there for this dating service or whatever. And they were 16-year-olds. And you would see under each picture, they would have what they thought they wanted for an ideal man. Age, desired age range, 20 to 60. Educational attainment, high school, like religious affiliation, not applicable. You know, it was just so broad. Like, they were willing to take any loser who was willing to pay, like, I don't know what it was, the $20 it was to take her address along with five other addresses so that they could start writing. And then I went through the whole, like, how-to process, and they actually had this whole spiel about how, like, I'm not making this up, Filipino women were genetically oriented to loving American men because of MacArthur, who had promised, I shall return. It was just like... And then years later, when I was writing this novel, I was like, I'm going to revisit these sites. I wonder if they're still up. And I actually found testimonials of, like, these men. They would have, like, you know, a teenager on each leg. The girls would be, like, in Hooters-type outfits, really short shorts, 10-gallon hats, all of them wearing 10-gallon hats. Oh, wow, this place is just great. You know, come in here, and it's like the food is great, the hospitality is great, and he's dandling the girls, and he's like, the women are beautiful. And basically what would happen is they would write to these websites, get these girls, narrow down which girls they wanted to see, and then they would fly in for, I don't know, a week or so, and narrow it down. It was like speed dating, like abroad. And they would narrow it down to like one or two finalists. They would choose the one. The agency would take care of all the visa arrangements, and then they would fly home with a new wife or a fiancé that they had to marry within, I don't know, however long the fiancé visa was valid for. And actually, Amy was saying that a lot of men would be repeat customers, because then they would send them home before the 2 years were up and then go in for another round of speed dating so that they could... Yeah, so isn't that awful?
That is one word for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this still happens today.
Yeah, you can look online and find it very easily. And not just the Filipinos. It's also the Russians.
All
you can
the
punch
world,
in maybe. Asian mail order brides. They'll show up, you know, every race.
The last question, I think you briefly mentioned, you're interpreting experiences and stories. There's a lot of confidentiality that goes with it.
Yeah.
And it's a lot to carry, especially with calls that come in dire straits. Have you considered putting that in story form?
Oh, my God. There are so many stories. Like, I've had to do a call where, like, a man was about to be taken off life support and his wife couldn't get the visa in time to fly over to see him before the doctors pulled the life support. So I was in a call where the social worker, the recruiter, the doctor, the wife, and myself, it was a 5-person call, were there to attend his death, basically. So the last thing the doctor said, and we had to stay in line after he left to pull the plug, was, I'm so sorry, but really, all his organs have failed. He's really just living on the life support, and we cannot keep him any longer on life support because you are not going to be able to get here in time. And so 10 minutes after, I'm going to take him off life support, and 10 minutes after I leave this call, he will be passed away. And of course, the social worker rushes in to say, and we will make sure to transport him as, you know, as quickly as possible to you, and et cetera. You know, it was just really sad. And so the doctor's like, do you have any questions? And up until that point, the woman is very calm. But as soon as he left the phone, and she started to wail, and she was just like these really sad sobs. And, you know, with the time difference, it was 4 in the morning. And she was like about to become a widow. And so the social worker's like, are you alone? Do you have someone with you? And, you know, she was with her 13-year-old son and he was asleep. So the humanity of these calls, I mean, you really feel like it's kind of an honor. It's also kind of a burden because what are you going to say? You are their only lifeline to, I want to say humanity. I mean, the people who speak English are also human, but for them to feel like valid, feel like they're making sense in a world that doesn't understand them, whether it's the court system or insurance companies or Medicare or a tax preparer. I mean, all of it is important. And unless you make yourself understood, it's really just, it's all pointless. What are you doing here?
We couldn't possibly end our conversation on such a sad note. So we talked about her transition to fiction writing.
I went through a period where I needed to write fiction. I was going through some kind of anger, I think. So I wrote something called Spooky Mall, which translated is a very rude word for the vagina, which means in translation, you're very scary vagina. And so it's very fun to ask for it in the Philippines because then all of the sales girls blush like, where is Spooky Mo? And the reason why it's called that is because all the aggressors are women and most of the victims are men. And so that was fun to write.
Well, it's a great novel. And thank you so much for your time and for chatting with me at KBOO.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Marivy Sullivan, the award-winning author of The Mango Bride. This is her first novel, which follows the intertwining stories of two Filipina immigrants in Oakland, California. You can keep up with Marivy Sullivan at her website, www.marivysullivan.com, as well as her Facebook page. I'm Sari Gameta. Thanks for listening.
Of Sheba this Thursday, June 6th at noon as we share an exclusive interview with reggae legend Max Romeo. Again, that's this Thursday, June 6th, Shocks of Sheba with Max Romeo, a KBOO exclusive.
Thank you. Join my feet, cause I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's me. Men themselves have wondered what they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. And when I try to show them, they say they still can't see. And I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ride of my breasts, the grace of my style. And now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me walking, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hands, the need for my care. Cause I'm a woman, phenomenally, phenomenal woman. That's you and you and me.
Good morning. And welcome to the June edition of Black Book Talk. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, and I'm here with
Patricia Welch, the library lady,
and Obie Hill, Mirror Image Books.
This month, we are so delighted to have with us Dr. Maya Angelou, who's written a new book called Mom and Me and Mom. Welcome. Dr. Angelou will start off by reading to us.
Thank you. Frequently, I have been asked how I got to be this way. How did I, born black in a white country, poor in a society where wealth is adored and sought after at all costs, female in an environment where only large ships and some engines are described favorably,